This is our fourth talk we are holding this week. Hopefully it will be enlightening as the past talks we've had this week. Today's lecture is going to be presented by Brother Dilwar Hussain from the Islamic Foundation, whose research specialty is based on history of Muslims in Europe. If you feel the history of Muslims in Western Europe or Europe is just based on the 20th century, you're in for a big surprise. Brother Dilwar.
Okay, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most gracious, most merciful. All praise is due to Allah. So, we're going to be talking about the history of Muslims in Europe, and some of you may think it's the local kebab shop down the road that we're going to be talking about, but hopefully we'll touch on things that are a little bit more useful to civilization than kebabs and curries. Other such things that you may be aware of. Does anybody know when the sort of interchange between Islam and the West, or Islam and Europe, or Islam and the sort of like the New World, when it started off? Anybody? 15th. Any other offers? Okay, which was about when? About 11th, 12th century. Anybody else? Go back a bit further. 7th century. Very good, very good. Educated audience. Surprising for a university. The interaction actually started very close, soon after the Prophet's life, after he expired. And what I'm going to cover in this presentation, I'm going to look at Western Europe and not Eastern Europe. I'm going to look at mostly just the history and not the sort of current period, because that's, you know, the brief I've been given. And I'm also going to try and look at some of the contributions that Muslims have made to Western civilization, to European civilization. I know that, you know, for some people it may be very difficult to appreciate, looking at the current situation of the Muslim civilization, how Muslims could have had any positive impact on anyone, never mind the West. But hopefully we'll be looking at some of those things as well. I'm not going to be looking at things like the Crusades, like Orientalism, because these are the contact points between Islam and the West. I'm going to be looking at the presence of Muslims in Europe and the influence that came over into Europe. It is a very big field, so I'm going to move sort of very quickly and try and cover a lot of history. If it's 7th century, then we've got something like 1300 years of history to cover. So what I'm going to be giving you is basically bullet points, ideas, very short, sketchy sort of overall picture of the situation, and I leave it to you to read about the details and perhaps, you know, cover the details in maybe other lectures. The actual first official contact point was when the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, sent a letter to Heraclius of the Byzantine Empire. Any of you seen the message? Yeah? A few of you? Not everybody? Okay, it's the message is a film produced, I think, sometime in the 70s, now available on DVD, for you all to watch. And, if a significant number of you haven't seen, I really recommend that the Islamic Society arranges a showing. It's a very good film. It's about basically the early period of Islam, the life of the Prophet, the life of the early companions surrounding the Prophet. And if you think back to the message, I know a lot of Muslims have seen it, so many of you here, Muslim members of the audience, will relate to this. Right at the beginning of the film, there are three riders who sort of, the film starts off with three people riding in the desert, and they're all sort of riding together, and then a point comes when they split off and they go in different directions. One of those riders was Dihya bin Khalifa, who was sent to Heraclius of Rome, of the Byzantine Empire. And this was in 628, so the Prophet was still alive at that time. In 652, Muawiyah, one of the leaders of the Muslim Empire, of the Khilafah, sent troops into Sicily in 652. And in 710, the first Muslim excursions arrived into North Africa from North Africa into Spain. By 732, there had been Muslim armies who had gone right through Spain and had entered parts of France, as close as Poitiers and Tours, which was something like 300 kilometers from Paris. So, you know, very close into the heart of Europe. And much later on, in 1529 and 1683, there were the two sieges of Vienna. We'll talk a little bit about all of these things in a while. There were, of course, also many other contacts. They weren't all just military contacts, and we'll focus on a lot of these sort of cultural and historical scientific interchange later on. But there was a lot of trade delegations, there's a lot of literary and cultural contact as well. And then later on, it was like a reverse phenomena where the Western world was reaching out into the East with colonialism, and then again migration from the Muslim lands towards the West. One of the first and most conspicuous aspects of Muslims living in Europe, or the history of Europe, is the Muslim civilization in Spain. And in fact, many people are not aware even that there was a Muslim civilization in Spain. Even for Muslims, if you mention this, for some Muslims, I know probably not all of you, they feel they're surprised that Muslims ever lived anywhere near a place like France or Spain or Italy, Sicily, these areas. But Muslims lived in Spain for almost 800 years. Musa ibn Nusayr, who was a governor in North Africa, sent the delegation, but he was actually in 708 he was appointed the governor. The story behind it is that there was a count who lived somewhere in southern Spain, and he had some sort of grievance against Roderick, the king of Spain at the time, around sort of 709-710, and in order to exact revenge on King Roderick, he went over to Morocco. And if you just to switch on the OHP, you'll see that right at the bottom of this map there, the distance between, this is Morocco, this is the northern tip of Morocco, and this is the southern tip of Spain. You'll see that there's not much distance there. I mean, it's just a short boat ride away. He went over to Morocco and said to some of the Muslim forces that if you come over and if you want to conquer Spain, you know, I'll try and help you because I want to get old Roderick back. At 710, a small delegation was sent to Spain, and then later on, the more famous delegation of Tariq bin Ziyad in 711. And Tariq landed in Gibraltar, and this is where the name of Gibraltar comes from. The Arabic is Jabal al-Tariq, Mountain of Tariq, and that's where the word Gibraltar itself comes from. In 712, his commander, Musa ibn Nusayr, came over, and there were now two sort of armies going through the south of Spain. Tariq came through Gibraltar, there's Gibraltar there, came through and went this sort of direction. Musa ibn Nusayr went around here in this sort of direction, and they met somewhere in Cordoba. They actually only stayed there for a couple of years, but by 715, phenomenally, most of Spain had been conquered by these two armies. By most of Spain, I mean this sort of the bottom three quarters of Spain. The northern sort of quarter always remained under Christian rule, but this sort of whole region became known as Andalusia or Muslim Spain. So in a matter of 5 years almost, the whole of Spain had come under Muslim rule. Some of the reasons behind that was that the Visigoth rulers of Spain were very divided, and therefore it was easy for, you know, when the Muslims came to take advantage of that division. Here we've got some of the periods of Muslim rule. In the first sort of 50 years, you've got the rule of the governors, and then this is considering the fact that the Muslim polity was centrally based in a place like Damascus, and anybody who was living outside, sort of as far as a place like Spain, were given governorships. But then as Muslim sort of presence in Spain started to become much more rooted, they actually developed emirs of their own within those localities. So you had governors first for the first 50 years or so, then emirs and caliphs. But then the Muslim rule itself started to sort of disintegrate, and there started to be divisions within the Muslim rule in Spain, and they split up into lots of local regional kings. And then there was a wave of sort of like a second wave, if you like, of migration and conquest from North Africa again, with the Murabitun, Muwahhidun, the Nasiris, and the eventually, when you got to the time of the expulsion of Muslims and the Reconquista, Inquisition, the last remaining remnants were named Moriscos. So you have there about, you know, almost 800 or 900 years of history, but a good 700 years of it being sort of like a very powerful cultural civilization that developed in Spain. Unfortunately, not much of this is talked about in until very recently in sort of history books. I don't know about you, but definitely when I was at school and when we were taught sort of Western history, none of this was mentioned. And if it was mentioned, it was like a very quick, you know, some Muslims lived in Spain and that was it. So unfortunately this history is very much forgotten. But we'll look at the significance of this later on when we look at some of the influences that Islam had on Western Europe. I'm going to skip a lot of this because I don't have that much time. It was in 1492 that the last southern region of Spain, sort of Granada, there we are, Granada. This is the last sort of stronghold of Muslims. In 1492, this collapsed, and the Muslims entered into a treaty with the ruling authorities, Alfonso and others. And by 1502, all Muslims were either forced to convert or expelled from Spain. In Sicily, sort of, if this is the map of Spain, then Sicily is somewhere over here. Again, there was for about 200 years there was a strong Muslim presence, starting off earlier than Spain, but it took a lot longer for Muslims to actually get a foothold in Sicily, some sort of 300 years or so. But again, by 1060 the Normans began to invade Italy from the north and drove out the Muslims in Italy. It wasn't just Sicily. If you think of Sicily, sort of like the bottom tip of Italy, Muslims had gone sort of across the eastern side of Italy, further north, creeping up towards Rome even, but didn't quite reach there. As the Normans sort of pushed these Muslims down, some of them migrated back towards North Africa, where they originally had come from. But others, you know, initially stayed under Norman rule, and they paid a sort of jizya, which traditionally was a tax that Muslims had taken from non-Muslims to protect as a sort of protected minority. Again, by 1153, there was forced conversion and deportation. France then, Muslims had entered France through this sort of, France is over here, this is in fact France there. And so all of this region, which was under Muslim rule, they had gone into France. But their venture into France was stemmed by Charles Martel. And then they remained there for about 40 years or so, 40, 50 years, and eventually left those areas. Okay. Austria. Now we come to the sort of the two sieges of Vienna. So far what we have is this sort of southern part of Europe, Spain, Italy, Sicily, Corsica, Malta, sort of this whole region, and you have North Africa sort of down here. Muslims have been coming into Europe from all these areas of North Africa. But Austria, it was the Ottoman Empire coming from the east of Europe that that came towards Austria. And these two sieges, which both failed, left behind significant numbers of Muslims as the armies retreated. Some of those people settled there, some they established mosques, cemeteries, some diplomatic relationships were established between Germany and sort of like the Ottoman state. By 1874, a law was passed that recognized some parts of Muslim family law. And in 1883, there was a German translation of some of the Hanafi codes of law so that the German authorities who had annexed Bosnia could deal with the Muslim minorities there. Okay. We have there then, we've looked at three or four countries, Spain, Sicily, France, Austria. You have sort of like the early history of Muslims living in Europe. Again, going back to Spain as the focus, because that was where the most significant aspect of the Muslim presence in Europe is. You had a civilization for about 700 years where people lived in, relatively speaking, in very good conditions. Peace, prosperity, Jews, Christians, Muslims lived together within the same civilization in peace and harmony. And historians are now noting that this is perhaps the only time that Jews, Christians and Muslims have lived to that degree of with that degree of peace and security. There were also other points, or historians are digging up all sorts of new situations as time goes by. These are I don't think you can see them too clearly, but these are some coins minted by King Offa of England. And I think Offa died in 796, so this is 8th century, late 8th century. And there's actually, if you look carefully, some of you may have heard of this, there's actually the Shahada written on these coins. And here, upside down, it says Offa Rex, King Offa. So this is one side of the coin, this is the other side. This proves that this was, a coin in circulation, and it was minted by the king. And curiously, on this side, there is the Muslim declaration of faith, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. People have sort of, peace be upon him, people have sort of mused over this. What does this mean? Did King Offa become a Muslim? Some people have said that perhaps he accepted Islam. Some people have said that maybe it was just some calligraphy that King Offa saw and liked, and therefore he had minted on his coin. Some people have said that it was used as a, because Muslims were using coins very early on in their history, as you can see here, 8th century, that this was a way of King Offa enhancing his trade potential within sort of some of the Muslim countries. Whatever be the truth, it shows one thing, that there was this contact between a country like Britain, England, and the Muslim civilization, so much so that even one of the, a symbol of authority, a coin, had a stamp of Islamic civilization on it. We're going to look at some of the sort of Muslim contributions now. Again, there is so much here. If you read the writings of people like Sayyid Hussein Nasser, some of the other sort of contemporary writers who are writing about Muslim science, about the impact of Muslim science on Europe. Even many of the Orientalists who have written very objective accounts, people like Montgomery Watt, you'll see the extent of this impact. First of all, if we look at the numbering system, now many of you will be aware that the numbering system we currently use in the West are called Arabic numerals, and I always used to wonder why are they called Arabic numerals. They look nothing like Arabic symbols. The theory is that the numbering system actually came from the Arabic numbering system. It was the Arabs that took civilizations like the Sanskrit Indian civilization, and they'd inherited sort of like a numbering system from them, developed it, enhanced it, and then had this had passed on through countries like Spain into Western civilization. If you imagine the impact that something like a numbering system has on a civilization, it may sound really small, but it has a really fundamental impact on the whole of the mathematics, and therefore computing and all the computational skills of that civilization. So this is one of those things, like the wheel, it has a fundamental impact on the whole of the civilization. If you look at language, there are many words actually in current English usage that are from Arabic. Words like admiral, I can't actually push this thing higher up, but words like admiral, which comes from Amir al-Rahal, alchemy, from alchemia, alcohol, algebra, algorithm, alkali. I've got a long list here, I'm not going to go through all of them, but you know, you can see some of them for yourself. And there's literally hundreds and thousands of words that are there. Coffee, cotton, cable, magazine, orange, sugar, that have come into common English usage through Arabic. The next thing we can look at is, continuing on the mathematical lines, algebra. I think most people are aware of Al-Khwarizmi's contribution to algebra, and this is where the word algorithm comes from. Have any of you watched Goodness Gracious Me? Some of you have seen it. You know, you have the sketch of this man who's he sort of asks his son, you know, have you heard of soap? Where does soap come from? India. You know, everything sort of seems to come from India. I'm not going down that sort of line. I'm not saying that everything comes from the sort of the Muslim civilization or the Arabs or Islam or anything like that. But what I'm trying to say is that there is a significant contribution that on the whole is ignored, and that has to be recognized. And as I said, you know, it's not just that the Muslims originated these things. There were many things that, you know, civilizations continue, they develop, they blend into each other. And there are many things that the Muslims took, like paper, for example, like the numbering system we talked about, many aspects of astronomy and mathematics, that they took from previous civilizations, from the Persians, from Indians, from Babylonians. They developed, enhanced, and had passed on to the West. Al-Khwarizmi wrote a book, Kitab al-Mukhtasar fi Hisab al-Jabr wal-Muqabala. Translation of that is the Book of Summary Concerning the Process of Calculating Compulsion and Equation. And it's thought this is actually a page from his book. This is translated into Latin, and it's thought that this book actually spurned off the whole idea of algebra in Western mathematics. Some of you may have heard this famous puzzle of the chessboard. If you have a chessboard, 64 squares, if you were to put one grain of rice on the first square, double it on the next one, double it on the next one, how many grains of rice would you have on the whole chessboard? I don't know if any of you studied maths, or you did that in sort of maths A-level or something like that, but it was Al-Biruni, it's somewhere here, you can't see it at the bottom. Al-Biruni, who died in 1048, again a Muslim scientist. And just like, even, you know, like many of their Western contemporaries, people of that age were not specialized in specific branches of science. So they were not astronomers or philosophers or scientists. Often they were all of them. People like Da Vinci, for example, you know, he was a great artist, he was an inventor, he was a philosopher, so many different branches of knowledge they'd mastered. Similarly, many of these people were of that same ilk. By the way, the answer is 1.8 times 10 to the power of 19. Astronomy, this picture's getting cut off. Here's a picture of an astrolabe, if some of you know what that is. We'll come on to that a little bit later. Muslims, I think, built the first observatories. As far back as 1259, there was an observatory built by Nasr al-Din in Marga. And then about 100 years later, another one in Samarkand, in Asia. The astrolabe is an amazing piece of equipment, actually. With this, you can determine the altitude of stars, the sun, the moon. You can tell the time. You could work out the height of mountains. You could work out the depths of wells. Amazing piece of gadgetry. And again, this is not completely invented from fresh by Muslims, but they have taken it on from Persians and other civilizations, and they developed it, enhanced it, and it came into usage again in the West. Here is a picture of, again, it's not coming out very clearly. This is the observatory in Samarkand. So you can see it's quite a magnificent sort of building. This is a representation of some of the Muslim astronomers. Quite a common picture if you read books on Islamic science. In the field of optics, Ibn al-Haytham, called Al-Hazen in the West, wrote a revolutionary book called Kitab al-Manadir. Now, in optics at the time, there was an idea that when we perceive something, when we see something, light comes from the eye, bounces onto the object, and therefore we see it. So you have some sort of energy coming out of the eye and then illuminating wherever the person looks. It was Ibn al-Haytham who said, no, it's not that. It's actually the reverse process. It's light that's coming from that object and entering the eye that allows us to perceive an object. So again, a groundbreaking sort of turn in the theories in optics. This book was translated into some of the Western languages in the 16th century. In medicine, perhaps, where there is perhaps the greatest contribution, in fact, there are four or five key figures in the branch of medicine that deserve mention. Ar-Razi, called Razors; Ibn Sina, Avicenna; Ibn Tufayl; Ibn Rushd, called Averroes; Ibn Nafis. You can see the sort of time they lived, around the 10th, 11th, 12th century. Hospitals existed in many civilizations, even before the Muslims. But because amongst the early Muslim civilization, the emphasis on hygiene, on purity, on cleanliness was there, hospitals were given a tremendous boost, especially around the time of Harun al-Rashid in sort of 8th century Baghdad. By the 10th century, there were actually groups of doctors who would actually tour poor areas of the countryside and go around cure people. I don't know if you can see, it's cut off there, but in 1284, there was a hospital built in Cairo called the Mansouri Hospital. This actually accommodated 8,000 people, and there were different wards, there were teaching areas, there was a library, so a very well-developed system. This is actually a picture of a hospital, an ancient hospital from Zanzibar. So again, you can see just a room where people were just thrown into a bed or something like that. Public baths, again, this idea of purity and cleanliness. You know, Muslims are, as you know, they have to wash before they pray. They have to bathe regularly. It may seem very obvious talking about these things now, but we're talking about a point in history where in some Western countries, even royalty would sort of bathe once or twice a year. So, you know, you have a very stark contradiction, contrast there in the sort of lifestyles and attitudes towards public health. The minor circulation of blood, the idea that blood circulates, there are two circulations, one that goes to the heart and one to the rest of the body, discovered by Ibn Nafis sometime before Galen and his discoveries on the circulation of blood. Diet, 12th century Andalusia, someone called Ibn Zuhr wrote perhaps what is the first book on dietary health. Ibn Sina, perhaps the most famous of the Muslim scientists, known as Avicenna in the West, wrote his magnum opus, the Qanun fi Tibb, or the Canon of Medicine. This is probably the most influential work in medicine ever produced. Just to give you an example, it was translated in 1473, first published in Europe. 2 years later, a reprint was made. Within sort of the next 25 years, there were 16 reprints of the book. It became so popular, so widespread, and anybody who was doing any serious medical research sort of had to study this book. It was so revolutionary. Ar-Razi at the bottom wrote a treatise on measles, smallpox, and also an encyclopedia on medicine. If we look at philosophy and learning, what we have to contrast and sort of bear in our minds is that we're talking about 7th, 8th, 9th century history. And at this time, if you look at what was going on in the East and what was going on in the West, this gives you an idea of the disparity between the civilizations, because at the time the Muslim civilization was at a high point, whereas Western civilization was going through, you know, what is commonly known as the Dark Ages or the medieval period. So there was this disparity. There was, you know, Muslim civilization was up here, Western civilization was sort of there. I mean, if we look at 9th century, the second bullet point there, one of the largest library in Europe, contained some 36 volumes. It was a monastery. Compare that with Cordoba, one of the great cities of Andalusia, where there were 500,000 volumes in the library of Cordoba. So again, partly this was because Muslims had greater access to paper, because paper at that time was, you know, it was just coming in. It was a new thing. It wasn't that everyone had full access to things, materials like that. Obviously, a stark contradiction to a very different situation to the position the Muslim community is in today. Even the whole idea of universities, learning, much of the inspiration came. I'm not saying Muslims invented universities. They were around, you know, even at the time of Plato, there was Plato's Academy. There were groups of people who would, you know, study under somebody else, or groups of the whole idea of the madrasa system, the Darul Ulooms within the Muslim civilization. This really gave a boost to learning, to thinking. And Azhar, for example, was established, again it's missing there, in 988, so late 10th century. Compare that with, you know, some of the universities in the West, Paris, I think sometime in the 11th century or even later. This is quite a useful quote that I think really summarizes the whole of what I'm trying to say, and it's Montgomery Watt. So today, an important task for us Western Europeans, as we move into the era of the one world, is to correct this false emphasis and to acknowledge fully our debt to the Arab and Islamic world. Montgomery Watt, in his book, The Influence of Islam on Medieval Europe. If we jump a few centuries now and look at the 19th and 20th centuries, by sort of the late 19th century, there were Muslims who were, for whatever reasons, had migrated or were left behind, as in the case of Germany after the sieges of Vienna. But the Muslim presence started to build up. I'm not actually going to look at the post-World War situation, which is, you know, has resulted in the sort of the current contemporary Muslim presence. I'm going to stop before then. But as early as 1830, Muslims had come to France as a result of colonization of Algeria. By 1866, a mosque was built in Berlin. The 1869, when the Suez Canal was opened, that should be 1969, not 1869. This led to the sort of the transfer of Muslims from Yemen and these places. Muslims from India had also come. With the colonization in India, there was a need for the colonial empire to bring about a new generation of people that would administer places like India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, you know, on behalf of the colony, and therefore a lot of people were sent over, civil servants were sent over for training to countries like Britain for their education. To conclude then, for most people, when they think of Islam and when they think of Europe, the two are sort of at completely different poles of the spectrum. They're two different things that can't mix. Islam is a new thing, it's a problem, it's a backward, perhaps, way of life, fundamentalism, all of these images that we're regularly bombarded by on TV. It's a problem that's just come about, I don't know, after the Iranian Revolution, after the Rushdie affair, after the Iran-Iraq war. These are the things that are there in people's minds. But what I'm trying to say here, for Muslims and non-Muslims, is that Islam is an integral part of Europe. It's not that the two are separate. If you consider that there were some 800 years of Muslim civilization ignore that history. You can't just take that away. And as far as the Muslim psyche is concerned, the whole, you know, it is God that created us, and it is God that created the earth. And it's not that a part of the earth belongs to God and a part of it doesn't. The whole of the earth is a creation of God. And therefore, wherever people are, you know, the earth belongs to Allah, it belongs to God. So the East is just as much Islamic as the West is, potentially. Especially if you consider the history, Islam is not a new phenomenon to Europe. Of course, the current type of presence is a different phenomenon, it's a new phenomenon, and it has its sociological implications, etc., etc. And that's a different debate altogether. One of the things that the Muslims in the audience must ponder upon, you know, we were talking about all of these, this glorious time and this high point in Muslim civilization and this contribution and that contribution. Well, what happened to it? You know, and this is something that Muslims really have to seriously think about. There was a time when I was reading, one of the books I was reading, I think it was by Sayyid Hussein Nasr, he was talking about the current state of the Muslim community. The world community, the Muslim Ummah, as Muslims call it. When people nowadays go to any sort of Muslim land, whether it's parts of Arabia or parts of Asia, you know, people look at the sort of the dirt and the discussion and the haphazard way of life and the low economic standards, and, you know, rightly so, people feel that these are not, we are better. You know, our civilization is better. But there was a time when travelers from Europe would go into the Muslim lands, and they would be very impressed by what they saw. They were so impressed that they were influenced by what they saw, that they were able to bring over from those Muslim lands things like the carpet, road street lighting, many of the things that we have today in terms of irrigation, sanitation, sewers. You know, they were so impressed by what was going on in the Muslim world, that they were actually in the position of being influenced rather than being in a position to influence others. That so it's known that the Christians who lived at the time of the Andalusian civilization, they were called the Mustarab. They were Arabicized because the civilization was so strong, was so powerful, that the Westerners who had lived there had become like the Arabs. Nowadays, it's entirely the reverse process that's happening. It's the Muslims who are westernized, mustaghrab, if you like. So again, you know, people have to think about these things. And these are, of course, natural processes. When a civilization is strong, it is bound to influence other civilizations around it. But I think Muslims really have to ponder what was it that made the Muslim civilization great, and what was it that made, or what was it that led to the downfall of that civilization, and what has brought Muslim civilization to the low point that it is at today. We also have to remember the very important role that Muslims who live in the West play. Just because Muslims in the West are a minority, just because they're a relatively small number, and by the way, the numbers are not that small. I mean, in this country there's some 2 million. In Europe, in Western Europe, there's some 12 to 15 million, if you consider the different countries. But if you look at the rate of development within Muslim communities in the West, education, the opportunities available to people, and you compare that with the opportunities available in the East, you can see that a time may well come where, you know, Muslims will have a greater opportunity to live in the West than in the East, in terms of practicing their religion, having access to education, employment, wealth, etc., etc. And also, if you look at the sort of the lack of planning that's going on in the Muslim countries, in terms of educational standards, how many people are unemployed, literacy. I mean, at the moment, there are things like oil and whatever, but oil doesn't last forever. It's a finite resource. There will be a time when it will come to an end. So what's going to happen then, when there isn't that political leverage that the Muslim world has over the West? So just to finish off then, and I'll give you sort of 10-15 minutes for questions and answers. It's a very important issue, Muslims living in the West. It's not, I know we've talked about it in a very sort of racy way. I've just pointed at dates and names, and that's all I've really done. But it's up to you to go and read about these things. It's up to you, because it's your heritage. You are European Muslims. You are Muslims who live in the West. You are Western Muslims, if you like. You are British Muslims, or whatever you want to call yourselves. It is your heritage, and it's up to you to find out more about it. And it's up to you to sort of tap into that history and realize that where Muslims once made a contribution, that we don't have to be in a position now and in the future where we are always asking for things, where we are always demanding our... You know, nowadays, if you look at the Muslim discourse, it's all about asking for things. It's all about, we want schools, we want halal meat, we want this, we want that, we want that. Well, what about giving? What about actually benefiting humanity? As those scientists, those astronomers, those doctors, those people of medicine did in the past. What about actually giving something to the civilization around you? That's my point. All I want to say. And I'll finish there, inshallah. Jazakumullah khairan. May Allah reward you all for listening and bearing with my presentation with patience. Thank you very much.